Find other great podcasts like this one at podmoth.network.
So I was looking for the documentary about this subject.
Sure.
And I thought that it was on HBO Max. My lovely partner, Joseph, said no. Caitlin watched it. It's got to be on Hulu.
Because Hulu is for trash.
Hulu is for trash, as this is not a trash documentary. But no. That is what Caitlin and I would say to each other when we would do like trash TV nights together. Hulu for trash.
Yeah.
But I said, why do you say that? He says, Caitlin's watched everything on Hulu. Every time you cover something on the podcast, the source is always from Hulu.
Yeah, I do love a Hulu show. They do pretty good work. This one was on the Netflix, though.
Really?
Or are you watching it on Hulu?
One of the ones you cited in your sources for this episode is on Hulu.
Okay, the like really long one?
Yeah,
okay,
the one that's several episodes long.
I think it's on both then, because we'll get into it, but it's like 8 hours long.
But we decided you were a dedicated Hulu ho.
Yeah, Hulu ho. I do love it.
In olden days, a glimpse of FEMA was only for morbid dreamers, but you're not alone. Bring anything round. Two goofy gals with deathly interest go on a skeleton inquest in your headphones. Anything bones.
And here we are. Welcome to Anything Bones.
Hello and welcome to Anything Bones. I'm Sophie, here for the history, Schwartz.
And I'm Caitlin, Bronco Car Chase from Hell Heart. And this is the podcast where we talk about bones and bone-related topics and whatever is topical and interesting and that we think people will listen to, hopefully.
Well, this week's episode is very topical and is a moment in true crime history, certainly.
Yeah, obviously we're talking about O.J. Simpson died like 2 weeks ago today, I want to say. On April 11th, it was announced, and he died of cancer at 76. We're going to go back and talk about all the things that led up to the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman, who are the, I think, two of the most like overlooked victims in all of this. We'll just get into it eventually. I think this is like obviously a really like well-known case, and it's kind of like intimidating to talk about.
Definitely.
But what I was thinking about is like, yeah. But what I was thinking about is like, okay, when all of this happened, we were like 2 years old, 1 year, like, so I obviously like missed the cultural significance of all of this and like going back and doing research on it. I also like talked to my parents about this case a little bit because my dad was like, yeah, all the lawyers that I knew were watching this case because it went on for 9 months.
Oh, yeah. I'm very sure my father followed this.
Oh, yeah. And I think my mom was like, I remember where we were when we were watching the Bronco chase, like you were in diapers, like, you know, that kind of stuff. So like.
So I'm here with Seth Schwartz, my father and attorney at law. Seth Schwartz, yes. Esquire.
That would be me.
What is your actual title?
Seth Schwartz, managing attorney.
I think that's a new one.
That is a new one.
But I just wanted to interview you very quickly about this week's topic because there were a couple questions that I had. So you're aware of the recent death of O.J. Simpson, correct?
That would be correct.
Do you remember like where you were when he was doing his infamous white Bronco car chase?
I recall exactly where I was, as a matter of fact. And as a matter of fact, I was with you at the time.
Really?
That would be correct. And we had rented a vacation home in a place called Yankee Point, which is down a little bit south of Carmel.
Oh, yeah.
And we were at that vacation house, the four of us, That's where we were. And in fact, you were watching it.
Really?
That would be correct. You were curious about it.
Oh my God. What was I, 1 year old?
Something like that. Do you remember what year it was?
94, I think.
So you were 1 year old.
It's a cultural moment that we obviously weren't a part of, but it's really interesting and so nuanced. And so there's just a lot to get into. So we're going to dedicate a whole episode to this topic.
Can I tell you kind of a silly connection I have to this?
Sure.
My grandparents lived in like Southern California at the time, mm-hmm. and I think had met and seen O.J. Simpson many a time.
Oh my
and
God.
And were big fans of him. Is it true that Papa and Nana had some sort of connection to O.J. Simpson?
That would also be correct.
What was the nature of their connection to O.J. Simpson?
In the Brentwood section of Los Angeles where Papa and Nana lived, and O.J. Simpson also lived.
Yes.
There's a place, I think, called the Mart, M-A-R-T. And it's a place, a very high-end place where they have select stores and also places to eat, a Mexican place. And it's used primarily by people in that neighborhood. And mm-hmm. Papa and Nana often or claimed to often see O.J. Simpson in... And they would say hello to him and he would say hello to them and everybody was very friendly.
That's so wild. Matt told me that, or he told me that there was some sort of connection.
Were they on Team OJ? Do you know?
I don't know what they thought, but I just know that they...
There was a connection.
There was a connection there. They were very fond of him. Did Papa and Nana ever voice their opinion on if they thought OJ was guilty or not?
I think Papa said that he thought OJ was guilty and Nana was undecided. She thought that he was such a nice man. And how could he do something like that?
I mean, I think she's reflective of many people's opinions.
That's correct.
Well, there was a time where everybody loved the Jews.
Oh, yeah. They're, like, everything that I watched and read, it, like, he was very charismatic outwardly. And then, like, there was just this inner darkness that not everybody saw. But when you did, it was like, oh, this is, like, scary because he was a big dude.
Yeah.
So, my sources for this, I read there were two articles from New York Times, crimemuseum.org. Wikipedia, obviously, all that's interesting. ABC News, a two-part episode of the Criminology podcast, and then the OJ Made in America five-part documentary, which if you want to watch, like, you really have to be invested. It's like five episodes and they're each 90 minutes.
But they're good.
They're so good. And it really, like, this is obviously, like, you could do... Like people have done, you could do films on this, you can write books on this, you can do a whole podcast on this case and the trial and never run out of content. And I'm going to try and sum it up the best I can.
But one thing I really loved about the documentary, just to like gush on it for 1 second.
Oh, because it's very good. It was made by ESPN also. I was like, okay, go off ESPN.
Yeah, that's what we were saying when we were watching. We were like, wow, ESPN. Particularly the episode that deals with like the Rodney King riots was incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
And it really paints a very strong picture of like both OJ and like America at the time.
And Los Angeles.
Los Angeles specifically, yes.
Yeah, and the like horribly racist and violent scary practices of the LAPD against Black people at that time. And it still continues to this day, to be quite honest.
I was going to say, there are hideously similar situations to, you know, what we see today and especially what we saw in 2020.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was just interesting to watch the documentary, having had the experience of seeing another extremely like tumultuous time for like awareness around police brutality.
Yeah. So for those who don't know, Rodney King was a Black man who was being chased by the LAPD, and there is video evidence of them just beating him with
four guys.
Yeah.
Against
he's on
one.
The ground, and they're beating him with like pipes or sticks. And a witness had a video camera and filmed it. And then the four.
Which is like not common for the time.
No, yeah. The documentary mentioned that this was like the first time that anything like that had actually been caught on camera in that way, like by a witness. And like the four white police officers that were tried for this crime were acquitted. And so the city was just fractured. This was happening right around the time that OJ was doing football and stuff. This case is so nuanced. It's about race. It's about true crime. Oh, it's a huge trigger warning for domestic abuse in this case. And it's just about like these broken families at the end of all this, like the Simpson family, the Browns, the Goldmans, everybody who was touched by these people is just, it's like they were never the same after this. So we're going to get into it. So O.J. Simpson's career began in the 60s. He was a college football star. He was a running back for USC, University of Southern California in L.A. 1968 was the year that he won college football's highest honor, the Heisman Trophy. In 1969, he was the first pick in the NFL draft, and he was drafted to the Buffalo Bills, where he like made a name for himself. In about 1979, he kind of retired from football and started making the transition into more Hollywood. He had some pretty famous Hertz commercials that people know him from. He was in, what is that movie called? Naked Gun? He was in that movie. He was in Naked Gun. Sorry, I had to double check.
No. Please.
I've never seen it, but the clips from the documentary made it look
very silly. Fun.
Dare I say, like, silly, funny.
Goofy.
Weird. Yeah. And he was doing a lot of other stuff. He was also doing, like, sports casting and TV stuff. Around this time, in the, like, very late 70s, early 80s, he is a frequent, like, visitor at this club called The Daisy at Beverly Hills, which was, like, for the who's who of Beverly Hills.
Ooh.
And Nicole Brown was 18 years old and working as a waitress at this club. And they met and like almost instantly connected. And then OJ, at the time that he met Nicole, he was married to his first wife, Marguerite Whitley, and they had several kids. I think they had three kids, and one of them unfortunately drowned like in their swimming pool.
Yeah.
Tragic. When he talks about it, it's very matter of fact. It's very, O.J. Simpson was very good at compartmentalizing. I will give him that, but not in a good way. So he divorces his first wife after he meets Nicole and marries Nicole in 1985. They had a daughter, Sydney, and then later a son, Justin. And by all accounts, Nicole was a very loving and like supportive mother of her two young children. But things were not what they seemed on the surface in regards to her relationship with her husband. So O.J. Simpson had this like very public persona, and it was, I think we were talking about this a little bit earlier. He was kind of one guy on the surface and, you know, was kind of like friendly and outgoing to everybody, but it was very superficial. Mm-hmm. And then if you tried to get any deeper, he like would just like steer the conversation away. And come to find out, he admitted himself that he was very unfaithful to her throughout their marriage. But the worst part of it, and this is where my trigger warning at the beginning comes in, Nicole reported numerous times that her husband was beating her and assaulting her. She started taking Polaroid pictures of like her face and bruises, and she would keep them in a safety deposit box. The police were called at least 8 times to their house, and nothing ever happened. Nicole said that basically that to police several times when they came here, that, you know, you get called out here all the time and you never do anything. So at one point in their relationship, OJ is charged with spousal abuse, but he pleads no contest to the charge and is sentenced to, this is crazy, 120 hours of community service, 2 years probation, and a $700 fine.
That's nothing.
To somebody who has NFL money, Hollywood money, that's
yeah,
nothing.
He's a millionaire.
I believe that in the documentary, they said that he did his community service, like organizing a golf tournament, like a celebrity golf tournament. So he spent most of that time golfing is
and
what I remember.
And he cheated at golf.
But yeah, they did. They did say that he cheated a lot.
That he would hide the ball in his pants and then drop it on the green.
I'm going to say it right now. He is not a good person. He was not a good person. Good riddance. Okay, so Nicole files for divorce from O.J. Simpson in 1992. After the divorce, Nicole is like finally feeling free in a sense. Again, she met him when she was 18 years old.
How old was
and
he?
So I believe he was in his mid-30s. Like there was like a pretty significant age gap between them.
Ugh.
So she like was embracing being single again, like was trying to move on with her life. But she remained a devoted mother. She would, you know, take care of her kids, drive them to all their practices and lessons and all these things. She got a condo that was not too far from Simpson's Rockingham estate, which is what they call it. Everybody's like, if you were anybody, you were at Rockingham, like hanging out. And I'm like, I would not want to be at Rockingham, actually.
In Brentwood, right?
Yeah, he lived in Brentwood. OJ has said some really interesting things, just like sidebar really quick. OJ has said some really weird and interesting things about race, where like I'm kind of paraphrasing here. Either he said it in the documentary or a friend of his said that he said it. The sentiment, I guess, was I'm not black, I'm OJ. Like he felt like he transcended race. And then he never brought up issues within the black community. He was not an advocate for any kind of community support or anything. He was just always neutral. And he lived in Brentwood, like, which was, you know, 90 something percent white people.
Rich white people.
Yes. So that's the kind of people that he surrounded himself with. So we're up to 1994. Throughout these years, allegedly OJ Simpson has been basically stalking Nicole. She reported that, you know, she would go to the gas station and he was there. She would go to the grocery store and there he was. So he really couldn't and wouldn't let her go. Police were still called from time to time. It sounds like they a couple of times tried to get back together, but they would fall into the same patterns again and again where he would become violent and she would leave. So in the weeks before her murder, she had struck up a friendship with Ron Goldman, who had eventually become one of the victims in this case. He was a 25-year-old waiter and aspiring restaurateur. There was a lot of speculation around the time of the case that there was something romantic in their relationship, but everybody that was close to them, everyone that knew them, said they were just friends. And the reason he was there that night was because Nicole and her family had had dinner at the restaurant that he worked at called Mezzaluna. And Nicole's mom left her glasses there. And he had kindly agreed to drop them off at Nicole's house. Back up a little bit. So it's June 12th, 1994. Nicole and the kids have breakfast and they go shopping. And then later on, they attend the daughter Sydney's dance recital. Apparently, OJ was at that dance recital, but he was not invited to dinner at Mezzaluna. So they go to Mezzaluna and then her mom realizes she left her glasses there. Ron Goldman agrees to come drop the glasses off on his way home. But somewhere between midnight and 4 a.m. on June 13th, police find Nicole and Ron's bodies outside her Brentwood condo, townhouse, I think. And both their bodies were outside in the like passageway between the steps to her house and the front gate. Nicole was stabbed 12 times and her neck was almost completely severed from her head. That's how bad it was. And Ron was stabbed 20 times. Just as if this isn't horrible enough, Nicole and OJ's children were upstairs asleep the whole time that this went on. I'll just give us a moment to breathe here.
Yeah.
It's really brutal. And I was just telling Sophie before we started recording, in like part 4 of the documentary about this. They show some pretty graphic crime scene photos, which were extremely upsetting for us. So definitely recommend, if you're going to watch the documentary, like, be prepared in part 4.
Yeah, we have not gotten to that part yet, admittedly.
It's okay. I'm going to spoil everything for you, but, you know, that's okay.
Well, I know what's going to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I will. I don't think I will watch the part with the crime scene photos.
So they never find the knife, that the murder weapon, but they do find bloody glove, hair, blood, and fiber evidence. And then because of all of the documented reports of police coming to OJ's house and Nicole's house, they immediately, you know, they think that OJ could have something to do with it. Or, as you know, you can also believe, they were worried that because Nicole had been murdered, that maybe something had happened to OJ because she was connected to him. One way or the other, they are like, we need to talk to OJ, like, immediately.
Yeah.
So, like I said, he was in Los Angeles on June 12th for that dance recital, but takes a late flight to Chicago that night, like, late at night. Right away, like, police call him and they get him to come back to LA the very next day to be interviewed. But he's like, they take photos of him. He has scratches on his hand, like, and he can't quite account for why. He's like, oh, I broke a glass. Oh, I fell. Like, they take pictures of it. They ask him questions. He's very cagey, but they don't really push him on anything and they don't arrest him immediately. But a few days go by, and on June 17th, so this is like 4 days later, prosecutors order Simpson to surrender to police to be arrested. And then, as many of us know, instead of surrendering to police, which was supposed to happen at like 11 a.m., nobody can find OJ. He's not at home. He's not with any friends or family that they can find. Robert Kardashian, who is famous father of Kim, Kourtney, Khloe, all of those people. Kardashian.
No, just those three.
There's a few. There's more. Robert.
Oh, well, Robert. Sorry, Rob.
Yeah. But then Kendall and Kylie are
Caitlyn's.
Caitlyn Jenner and Kris Kardashian.
I'm sorry, Rob.
Sorry, Rob. Excuse me.
Excuse me, Rob.
Pardon me. Sincerest apologies.
Sincerest apologies, Rob.
Have you seen that show, Keeping Up with the Kardashians? Did you ever watch it?
I was an on and off watcher of the Kardashians show, but I just would remember him just kind of always in the back, and then they'd be like, and Rob's here too.
Yeah, yeah, that was kind of the vibe. Okay, anyway, back to 1994. So Robert Kardashian Sr., not the one we were just talking about, Sr., reads this letter that OJ wrote that gets people kind of freaked out because it sounds like he's going to commit suicide. He's saying that he wants people to remember the old him, like, he wants to be with Nicole, like, all these things that make it seem like he wants to end his life. And so everybody's looking for him, like, journalists, police, everybody's looking for him. And then they spot his white Bronco on the freeway in Southern California, and police eventually, like, catch up to him, but they don't stop the car. They don't arrest him. When you watch the news coverage, it's just a white Bronco going down the empty freeway. They cleared off the freeway, and it's like a motorcade.
So he could trundle down the highway. Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah, we were just watching the footage of it, and it is wild. They are not chasing him. They are following him.
Yeah, just waiting for him to stop or, like, run out of gas or something. It's very bizarre.
Yeah.
95 million Americans watched this incredibly famous quote-unquote car chase on TV. Yeah. From home. I think one of the podcasts the criminology podcast was like, orders to, like, Domino's and any pizza place that delivered, like, skyrocketed when this was happening because nobody wanted to, like, go out.
Everyone was like, cancel all plans.
Well, it was kind of like,
the plan now.
Well, everybody knew who OJ was. They, like, he was very famous, very adored, like, well-liked. People were lining the streets, like, of the whole length of the freeway. They, I mean, like,
it would be like if John Cena did this. Like, yeah. It'd be like, oh my God, John Cena's doing what?
Yeah. And so helicopters are overhead. People are on the ground going nuts. And all the time, OJ is sitting in the back and his friend Al Cowlings is driving. And he has two framed photos of it in his hands. I don't know what they were of. And he has a gun with him. And he's on the phone with police for some of it. And he's like saying that he wants to be with his mother, like go see his mother, go to her house, I guess. And then it's just like, let me go to my house. And eventually in this, after this like long drawn out, like hours long process, he goes back to his house and surrenders to police and they arrest him. Like, what?
He just wanted to go on a nice drive.
He just wanted to go on one last slow crawl along the freeway before his trial. I don't know. I think it was like to buy time or to people feel sorry for him. I don't really know what this was about. It's very wild.
I mean, it seems like he wanted to kill himself, but then didn't.
That is possible.
Could have also just been a sympathy ploy. He could have been having a mental breakdown.
Yeah. It could be any number of those things. It could be all of those things.
Can I add a tangent just very quickly?
Absolutely.
Many years later, OJ would produce and star in a prank show.
Oh my God.
Called You've Been Juiced or something to that effect.
Yep.
Where he attempts to sell the white Bronco to unsuspecting strangers. Yes, that is one of the pranks.
Oh, no. They didn't show that in the documentary. They showed a little bit of that where he like dressed up as an old man. There was one where he was selling oranges on the side of the road.
It's truly bizarre.
Was he trying to do like a punked situation?
Yes.
Was punked happening at that point? It must have been.
But he's a man who was on trial for murder.
Yeah, it's so just not
It doesn't
great.
Really hit the same.
It hits different. It hits different.
Especially when you're trying to sell the escape vehicle.
That, yeah.
Wild.
That's just seedy. That's just really seedy. Oh,
it's all super disgusting.
Ugh.
He is a disgusting human being. Anyway, yeah. Continue.
Yeah. Okay. So here we are. We're in January 1995 at the trial of the century. So the Judge Lance Ito, allowed cameras to be in the courtroom the entire time, which was very, like, different, I think. That wasn't, like, very common.
Yeah.
There are, like, older videos of court cases, obviously, but I don't know that the, like, this was like 24-hour news when there wasn't a 24-hour news cycle. You know what I mean?
Yes. Plus, like, this was, like, unprecedented in many, like, ways.
Right. So it just brought more and more pressure on this already, like, very fraught situation. I think this quote sums it up pretty well. I believe this was from the New York Times. Quote, many people were drawn in by the sensational and scandalous aspects of the case, including fame, celebrity, the troubled relationship between OJ and Nicole Brown Simpson, the gruesome nature of the crime itself, and racial dynamics, since OJ was black and Nicole Brown Simpson and Rod Goldman were both white. For many in Los Angeles, it was hard to ignore that this trial happened so soon after the Rodney King riots.
As we just talked about, there's a whole context around this.
There was a lot of distrust of the police in LA among black citizens because there were white cops that were just senselessly killing and beating black people regularly. And the video of Rodney King being beaten was different, but everybody knew that that was what it was like. Like in LA
yeah,
at that point.
Yeah, it was
point.
Like finally catching on camera.
Exactly.
What people knew to be happening all the time.
So people were very distrustful of the police.
I mean, honestly,
rightfully
extremely
so.
Rightfully, yeah.
Exactly. So the crime happens in Brentwood, but they decide to move the case to downtown Los Angeles. And presumably it's so that O.J. Simpson will get a jury of his peers who are black. And so what ends up happening, there are 10 black people on the jurors and 2 white people on the juror that end up acquitting him. We all know this happens. There's no spoiler here.
Do you know any more about the jury selection, or were you going to keep talking about that?
So, like, in the documentary, they talk about how they surveyed like 2,000 people in Los Angeles. And it was, I guess, yeah, downtown was predominantly a black area. And then where the crime had taken place, it was a predominantly white area. And so they made the decision to move the whole case downtown. And so it also was going to be at least a 6-month trial. So most people were like, no, I can't, like, out of commission for 6 months. It ends up going for 9 months.
Just wild.
Yeah.
The reason that I was interested in it is it, in a way, kind of reflects a bit of what we're experiencing right now with the Trump case.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've been following it, but jury selection has been what the kids call difficult.
Yeah.
Because it's like a person that everyone knows and mm-hmm. everyone will have an opinion on.
Strong opinions on, yeah.
So they've had to like boot several members and they have a million alternates. But, you know, trying a public figure is so fascinating to me.
Well, yeah. And you're trying, like, it's like this game, weird. They called it like a weird game of chess, basically. You're like trying to figure out who is going to be sympathetic to who and like who's going to be on what side. And the lawyers only have a certain number of people that they can like turn away. So it's just it's really interesting. And like no matter who you are and how much you like can portray that you're objective, you're probably going to come in with some biases that you're not even aware of.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And like as we were talking about, the majority of the black community in L.A. was very rightfully distrustful of the police. So what ends up happening in this case is that the defense is able to plant the seed that the cops planted a lot of this evidence at OJ's house, which is what we're going to come to find out. There's a bloody glove at his house. There's blood and like fiber evidence in his like yard and on his car. And there's a matching glove at the crime scene that also has the victim's blood. So the defense is able to spin that to where the jury is thinking that the police planted all of that. And because they're so rightfully distrustful of the police, it's not that big of a stretch.
I mean, yeah, that's so tough.
It's rough. So OJ's defense team was comprised of the so-called dream team. I'm just going to name a few of them because there were like a fuck ton of lawyers on this team. Most famously, Johnny Cochran Jr., F. Lee Bailey, Alan Dershowitz, Barry Scheck, and Robert Shapiro. Robert Kardashian was like there, but he never like said anything in court. So he's just like in all the pictures, but I don't know how much he did because he wasn't a criminal attorney.
I was going to say, he's not a trial boy.
No. He was there, though.
Yeah, he was there with his really cool hair.
And the prosecution was led by Marsha Clark and Christopher Darden, and they had a few other attorneys that they seemed to be working with. So as I was kind of saying, the prosecution had a lot of evidence that OJ committed this crime. There was blood evidence, shoe prints, hair, fibers, carpet threads that connected the murder scene and OJ Simpson's car and his house. There was also all this evidence of abusive behavior that OJ exhibited against his wife that police like witnessed, were called to over and over and over. But admittedly, the police did not do a fantastic job on this case.
They beefed.
Photo evidence was lost and mislabeled. DNA was stored improperly. And then the biggest kicker in the case was a witness, Detective Mark Furman.
Furman.
So Mark Furman is also a piece of shit.
Furman.
Yeah. So Mark Furman was one of the first officers on the scene. He went over the gate to OJ's property without a search warrant, when they thought that he was in danger, quote unquote. I think that was the reasoning they gave.
In the documentary, that's what he said. He was like, I was worried OJ was also murdered. And
it's like, well, anyway.
I mean, I guess, but...
They did get a warrant eventually. Like, yeah. It was gonna be found anyway. But this fucking guy. So the defense gets up to question Mark Furman when he's on the stand. And they ask him, have you said the N-word in the last, like, 10 years? And he says no. Later on in the trial... The defense is presented with audio tape evidence of him talking to this, like, screenwriter who's apparently writing a movie or a show about the LAPD. And he's just talking about Black people and people of color like they're animals. He's saying racial slurs. It is disgusting.
Furman, you piece of shit.
So they bring him back onto the stand and they're like, hey, did you lie when you were in court before? And all he says over and over and over is, I plead the fifth. So when they, and apparently, according to Mark Furman, because he's in this fucking documentary, like you were saying, apparently when you plead the fifth to one question, you have to plead the fifth to all questions. Allegedly, according to Mark Furman. So when they ask, did you plant evidence at the crime scene? He says, I plead the fifth. He looks like complete shit in front of the jury. And they play snippets of those tapes to the jury to bring up, is he a credible witness or not? Because basically they're saying, the defense is saying that if Mark Furman could do all these things, he lied to you. Kuno.
What's up, Bubba? He hates Furman. He was barking at him in the documentary earlier.
Yeah, even the mention of him.
Well, Kuno's just saying that he wished that it was any other cop that found the glove.
Oh, God, anybody else.
I know, Bubba. I wish, too. This guy's a piece of shit and he's not credible, but it was there.
I believe that the glove was there and this was just a very lucky break for the defense. But Mark Furman is a piece of shit.
Yeah. Ugh.
It all is bad, okay? It's all bad.
Nobody wins.
So they undermine his credibility incredibly badly in front of the jury and make it seem like he feasibly could have planted the evidence. They also try to say that there's this chemical called EDTA in the blood samples, and EDTA is in vials in laboratories. But then Marsha Clark gets on the screen and she's like, there's EDTA in everything. Like, there's EDTA in your blood right now. Like, shut up. So they're trying to spin that police could have planted all of this evidence. Like, the blood evidence could have come from a vial collected of OJ's blood when he was, brought to the police.
Hey, fellow truth seekers. I'm Justin.
And I'm Brandy. And together, we'll be your guides on this spine-tingling journey through the unknown.
We dive headfirst into the eerie realms of cryptids, from Bigfoot to Loch Ness Monster.
And hold on tight, because we'll explore spine-chilling encounters with extraterrestrial beings and UFO sightings that will leave you questioning what's really out there.
Beyond the Shadows is not your average paranormal podcast. Our goal is simple, to shed light on the shadows that haunt our world and confront the unexplained with an open mind.
And for the skeptics, don't worry, we have something for you too. Our conspiracy theories will challenge your beliefs and make you question everything. So, if you're fascinated by the paranormal, yearn for chilling true crime stories, or crave the adrenaline rush of uncovering conspiracies,
join us on this hair-raising adventure as we journey beyond the shadows.
After all the stuff with Mark Furman, the trial's plodding along. Again, this thing goes on for 9 months, and the jury is sequestered in a hotel, away from everybody for this whole goddamn time.
That sucks.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a five days a week type of thing?
They couldn't watch news coverage, so I'm pretty sure they just had to stay there the whole time.
But I mean, how many days a week would they be in court? for nine months.
Probably 5 days a week. But they can't like take the chance that the jury is going to see news coverage because it was everywhere.
God, that'd be so hard to do now.
Yeah, there you can't be impartial if you see news coverage of all of this.
Yeah.
But I couldn't imagine being stuck in a hotel for 9 months by myself.
Oh, God.
Anyway, so the Mark Furman stuff is a complete disaster. The second big disaster of the case is the glove.
Oh, God.
The glove. Okay. So the glove. Said glove that the defense says Mark Furman planted.
Found by Furman,
unfortunately. But there was one at the crime scene and one at OJ's house.
That's two gloves.
Just by the way, in the documentary, Marcia Clark says that she did not want this to happen, but that her colleague, Christopher Darden, did want him to try on the glove. And he was standing up in court and just said, like, please try the glove on.
No.
It was a bad, bad idea. Because when OJ put the glove on, first off, he had latex gloves on first. Latex gloves are like kind of sticky, right?
Grippy.
These gloves have been soaked in blood and dried. So when he puts them on, he appears to struggle with these gloves.
God.
He is hamming it up for the jury. He is like
Mr.
showing
Naked
them
Gun.
his hands, flipping them around like, look at this, guys. Like, wow, these gloves do not fit. I was watching that. They looked like they fit pretty well. They were snug, but like a normal person, I would think, would just say like, oh, he's got latex gloves on underneath. Apparently, according to his agent, who was interviewed in the documentary, he also didn't take his arthritis medicine for like 2 weeks. So his hands were swollen and he couldn't bend his knuckles very easily.
Trickster.
So closing arguments are given. The jury goes out and deliberates for 3 hours.
Are you kidding me?
3 hours. A nine-month trial. Yes. 3 hours they deliberate.
I could talk about a movie for three
I
hours.
I know. We could record this episode in 3 hours.
Yeah.
And we're still barely scratching the fucking surface.
That's so wild to me.
3 hours and they come back. As we all know, they find him not guilty.
Ugh.
This is rough, I know.
It is.
Hang in there.
I'm hanging, but I'm not happy about it.
No. So he doesn't totally get away with things. This is not the end of the story. Even though he could have faded into obscurity, he did not. There was a civil suit presented by Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown's families. And because there is a looser standard of proof in civil court, the court found O.J. Simpson culpable of the murders of Ron and Nicole, and the families were awarded $33 million in damages, which they would never see all of, but, yeah. You know, it's a nice gesture.
But it's like, we always talk about this when it comes down to, like, the civil suit or the wrongful death suits and stuff like that. Yeah, like, money cannot replace a person.
No, of course not. I mean, I think they got what they wanted for the most part just by one court of law saying, like, yes, the evidence points to him having done it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's the best you can have in a legal sense because of double jeopardy.
Yeah. The Goldman family, though, is not done with O.J. Simpson. By a long shot, and they are going to fucking take him for all that he is worth.
As they should.
They do their darndest. So after he is acquitted of the double murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman, he gets custody of his children back. And they all move to Florida in the year 2000 because in Florida, the law protects homes and pension income. So they can't be seized in court because of court judgments. So the Goldman family wasn't able to take any of that money from him. What they did instead, I am floored by. This is the shit. Okay. Almost a decade after this trial, so around 2007, obviously this is being planned before that, this book starts
being promoted.
I know exactly
what you're talking about. Yes.
A book called If I Did It, Confessions of the Killer, which was going to be published by Reagan Books, which is an imprint of HarperCollins, whose chairman, blah, 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 is Rupert Murdoch.
Ugh, he's a shithead.
It's connected to Rupert Murdoch, but it's run by this lady, Judith Reagan.
Boo.
And she's like, fuck yeah, I know what we need to do. We're going to have somebody ghostwrite this book that for OJ, who is painting this like hypothetical picture of what the murder would have been like from the killer's perspective if he had done it. So the ghostwriter is interviewed in the documentary, and he says that he was convinced that O.J. Simpson was a murderer when he went into the meeting, and he left the meeting being even more convinced that he was a murderer. So that fucking says it all.
I mean, I didn't need that. I am already convinced, right? But that's pretty strong.
So before this book is even published, there is such a massive public outcry about him profiting off of a book about a double murder that he was acquitted of.
Yeah.
And so they pull the project, and this lady, Judith Reagan, like loses her job, and she is like kicked the fuck out of there.
Sorry, Judy.
But like I said, Ron Goldman's dad is a badass, and they secure the rights to publish this goddamn book the same year, 2007, as it's supposed to be published. They are not holding back. Ron Goldman's dad, Fred, in the documentary he is still mad to this day, and he has every reason to.
Yeah.
Like, that man just murdered his son for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
So he says that the only thing they changed was that the cover, like the title of the book, it says, I did it. The if is like really tiny and embedded in the letter I of I did it. So that's what they changed about it, he says.
I love it.
And so they publish it, and all the money from that goes to them to like settle this civil damages. They're never going to get to $33 yeah. million, but they did their fucking damnedest.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that he had the fucking gall to do that.
To, like, what? Like, were you so worried about obscurity that you wanted to do this to like get attention? Was it your, like, because Double Jeopardy exists, like you feel like you can say whatever you want? Like, it's bizarre that he would ever like agree to it, or that anyone would think the public like wanted that.
Yeah, I mean, I can see some people in the public really wanting it, but it's just disgusting. Like,
just the idea of it, I'm like, no, I'm good.
I mean, there's a reason that there's laws around people profiting off of their crimes.
Exactly. So again, you would think a normal person might just like shrink back into obscurity, like, okay, this was really bad, I'm not gonna do anything in the public limelight, I'm just gonna like play golf and chill in Florida for the rest of my life,
keep cheating at golf and fade away,
keep cheating at golf and just like zone out,
die.
No. Around the time that book is due to be published, he's invited to this wedding in Las Vegas, and he, you know, just so happens to find out that there are some sports memorabilia dealers that have like some of his personal effects. And, you know, those are his property. Like, they stole that. He wants that back. So he and a bunch of like these guys that he like his friends, like his buddies that have guns, they like storm into this hotel room in Vegas, and they like hold up these memorabilia dealers at gunpoint and are like, give us all your shit.
Oh, like, my and God. OJ,
and it's recorded, and OJ is like screaming at them like, this is mine, like all this stuff. And it's like signed pictures that he signed like years ago, and like signed footballs and stuff.
So scary.
Later on, he's going to say that like he thought it was stuff like his Heisman trophy and like his like football that he was carrying when he did the 2,000-yard dash, like all this shit that like was either sold or like was in a storage unit, and then he didn't pay for the storage unit, so it all got sold eventually.
Yeah,
so it's like not like people stole it from him, like it was sold, or like, I mean, maybe some of it was stolen, but like, who fucking cares? Like,
it's not yours anymore.
But because of all of this, he is charged with several felony counts, including kidnapping and armed robbery.
Really?
And it's kidnapping because he's recorded as saying, like, no one leaves this room until I get such and such.
That is kidnapping.
It's kidnapping.
That's kidnapping. I'm sorry, guy.
Ironically, on October 3rd, 2007, like 13 years after his acquittal in LA, which was very probably planned and very poignant, he was found guilty of these felony crimes and was sentenced to a maximum sentence of 33 years.
Wow.
To be served in Las Vegas. Now, he was paroled 10 years later in 2017. And I totally remember when this happened being like, what yes. the fuck? O.J. Simpson is out? And then I was like, why is O.J. Simpson in jail again? Like, I know he was acquitted of the murder. Like, what is what? Yeah. So I kind of remember hearing about this and being like vaguely intrigued
because
and disgusted,
he,
you know?
Didn't he tweet?
I think he did tweet. And then he had, I don't know if he had the prank show after he was out of jail or before, you know, I'm not sure.
Let me look it up real quick. 2006. So this is before
okay, it was
he went
before.
To jail.
It was right before.
Yeah.
Okay. So I stand corrected. He did all that shit before jail.
Got oh, thank God.
Good. Wow. Got out in at the end of 2017. And then like we started off this episode on April 11th, just a couple weeks ago, his family announced that he had died of cancer at 76 in Florida, yeah. where he has been this whole time hiding from the Goldmans. Excuse me, hiding his money from the Goldmans.
Yes. Putting it in his lodging so that he cannot have it taken.
Yep.
He was cremated.
Was he?
He was. I was trying to figure out what happened to his body. But
yeah.
he was cremated and there's no public information available about his memorial. So
he might maybe he won't have one. I mean, who knows? Maybe like know, private, probably.
Probably private. I mean, I don't know.
I saw a crazy headline in the news like right after he died that I do not think is true. And that I also asked my dad about because I was like, what the fuck? We don't think it's true. There's a headline that he had, like, the people that were closest to him on his deathbed sign an NDA.
I
kept
saw
seeing
that
shit
too.
Everywhere, and I was like, what the fuck? So I asked my dad, I was like, would that even make sense? And he's like, no, it wouldn't hold up. Like, it doesn't make sense. Like, why would you do that? And, that, you know, like, so it doesn't, I don't think that's true, but I think that's, like, whoa.
I mean, I don't think that's true either because he doesn't care who knows it.
Why would you he care? You're about to die.
Well, and he also wrote a whole stinking book about it.
Yeah. Like,
he does not care. He prank showed sold the Bronco.
Yeah, like, that's bizarre.
He does not care. He's proud of it.
Ugh. But yeah, so this case, like, so many moving parts, like a lot of players and just a lot of sadness. And I feel like in the hype and like busyness of the trial, people kind of forgot about Nicole and Ron.
Yeah.
And like, again, I understand the distrust of the police at that time. Like, logically, it makes sense to me. But I can't figure out how all of this evidence could be overlooked, like, because, like, people wanted to get back at the establishment. Does that make sense?
Yes.
A lot of people, and that's not, like, my words, actually. Like, in the documentary, they're like, a lot of people felt like OJ's acquittal was, like, them getting back at the four white police officers that were also acquitted of beating Rodney King on camera and getting away with it. And all of this makes logical sense to me, but I just like deep down, I know he did it. So it's just really hard to wrap my head around.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I feel like I definitely have no place to speak on, you know, how the Black community was feeling about the police. But I heard an interesting take about the DNA evidence, and I just looked into it a little bit. But the first time that DNA evidence was used in court was only 1986. So, like,
not even 10 years before the trial.
Exactly. So I feel like it didn't have the gravity that it would have in a case like it would have today.
Yeah.
Today, we understand because of all the court cases that have used it since 1986, the importance of DNA and the open and shut nature of DNA as, you know, evidential to murder.
Right. Yeah.
And so that maybe was not perceived as final as it would be in a case today.
That, and like, if you're convinced that a cop planted that evidence, what does it matter if it matches him?
Exactly. So it's just, it doesn't matter.
And hindsight is 2020. Like, looking back on this from 2024, I have no idea what those jurors were feeling.
Yeah.
And like you said, like what it was like to be in LA at that time for anybody, but particularly for a Black person. So it's just, that plays a huge role in this case, DNA evidence, and maybe not understanding it or like mistrusting it.
Yeah.
It just, there are so many moving parts. The jurors didn't like Marcia Clark. They didn't like Chris Darden. Like, it didn't click. So many things along the way didn't click. Mark Furman came off horribly on the witness stand. So all these things interconnected brought us to like where we are. And it just like, it was this crazy like confluence of events that could never have happened at a different time in LA, in America. Like in, it's wild. And I really thank you for listening for an hour. And if you're like me and kind of missed this due to being a baby when it happened, I hope this was informative for you.
Yeah. And ask your parents about it. They'll probably have something interesting to tell you, as your parents often do.
Go ask your parents.
Go ask your parents, because that's what we did. No, thank you for presenting this. This is a topic I know you were super passionate about.
Thanks. The OJ Made in America docuseries, like if you can go for 7+ hours, it's worth it. And like I said, there's a ton of other like media about this topic because it was very well documented and like it's fascinating and there's so many different takes, and consume it all.
The interviews are so powerful. There's one with, I think it is, was it Ron Goldman's father, who was talking about how he had all the plans for his restaurant all laid out that he wanted to open, you know, like, you know, every last detail, and that it was his like passion.
Yeah, he was 25 when he died, just like, had just moved to LA not that long ago, like was working at a restaurant and like you said, had these plans to open his own space. And like all of that was just taken away just because he returned some glasses at the wrong time. And Nicole's life was taken also senselessly for no reason. And nobody deserves to die like they did. And I need to go hug an animal. So like and subscribe, vibe, and as always, bone. Voice crack.
Voyage.
I've been talking too much.
You're a real chatty Kathy.
Bye.
Real chatty Caitlin. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to Anything Bones. Follow us on Instagram or Facebook at Anything Bones Podcast, or email us at anythingbonespodcast@gmail.com.
Thank you to Nick Kruger for our spooky music, and Steven Vetteroff
at Chubby Scrubby on Twitter
for our jazzy vocals. And thank you to Camilla Franklin
at Camilla Strader on Instagram
for our beautiful bony artwork. Please rate, review, and subscribe.
Well, thank you so much, Dad. I love you, and you're the best.
I love you too, Sophie.